Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's a very great pleasure to welcome you all back to the second of these two lectures by James Olson on accounting information and corporate valuation. In the first lecture, he shook some orthodoxies, at least in the school, although I don't think I felt the earth move very much when he cast doubt on the use of NPV as a way of evaluating capital investments. Tonight, he's going to address the issue of equity valuation. And those of us those of you, I'm much too cautious, those of you who gamble on the stock exchange should take notes. Professor Olson.
As the director indicated, it is indeed the case that tonight I'm going to talk about the nature of equity valuation and accounting data. And one of the things that's going to be important is that when you think about this problem, it can be viewed as an extension of the problem I discussed Tuesday. In other words, if you think about what you do when you invest, it's very much like a capital expenditure. In other words, you're buying a collection of assets, and you have to ask questions how this investment is going to work out in the future. So I'm sort of going to come back to that theme that essentially throughout the analysis of the mode of reasoning, the concepts are very similar to the concepts that you invoke in the case of capital budgeting more generally. Let me first give you a sense of the more precise issues here I plan to deal with. There are four points I'd like to discuss. The first one has to do with how one thinks about equity values in terms of current accounting data. And this kind of question always sort of raises interesting issues because depending upon who you talk to, there's sort of various points of view. Some people tend to think about stock prices and the value of stocks as being rather independent of accounting data. And the issue always comes up if it's sort of possible to think about equity values as in fact reflecting precisely up to an approximation of what you see in the current balance sheet and what you see in the current income statement. My general contention here will be that once the concepts are sufficiently appreciated, the data is in fact extremely supportive to certain basic ideas in terms of how book values and current earnings show up in the current stock prices. The second question here relates to how we explain returns. Traditionally in accounting research, we tend to focus either on market values or changes in market values, and presumably that we expect some consistency. So I'm also going to look at a very important question in terms of accounting research, and that's how we think about the way changes in equity values relate to earnings. And there's sort of important questions here in terms of concepts as well as the empirical evidence and how one obtains appropriate conclusions. And a third question, which is really an extension of the second one, has to do with the issues I raised Tuesday night. And it concerns if there are different components in earnings, if they sort of count differentially. One can sort of in particular visualize that if you want to explain market returns, but what really counts are cash flows, as opposed to certain accrual items like depreciation expense and whatever have you, which presumably in some sense would be much less important. So stated somewhat differently here, the empirical question becomes, are all revenues and expenses in some sense equal? Or is it the case that when we look at earnings, we really want to look at the details of the line items rather than the aggregates? Now, the answer to this question is going to depend upon exactly the mode of analysis. But one of the conclusions here I'm going to propose tonight is that once you look at empirical data properly, it is in fact the case that in some sense all line items are equal. There's sort of really no need to differentiate between the accrued components of earnings versus the cash flow components of earnings. And the fourth question here is sort of really an extension of the first three questions, and it has to do with the question if it makes sense for managers to focus on earnings when you think about the value creation process. And again, that sort of relates to issues I discussed Tuesday. Maybe managers should measure the creation of value using non-accounting data rather than accounting data. My contention here is going to be that once we look at the problem properly, the data will in fact support the notion that it makes a lot of sense. What managers really should do is to focus on the creation of earnings. And sort of in the long run, companies that do create earnings will also succeed in the marketplace in the sense that you're going to see the maximization of shareholders' value. Before I go on, I would like to make some general comments here about why accounting research spends so much time focusing on how accounting data relates to market value and market value changes. Many of you here, of course, know that over the past 25 years, there's been a substantial effort in accounting research to deal with the whole issue of how market value changes relate to accounting data. It's never been obvious to standard setters in particular why this effort is undertaken. Incidentally, I might mention here is that the UK is only lagging in this regard because it took longer for them to get the databases. But once the databases are in place, you're going to see the same kind of research. And in fact, over the last 5 years, there's been quite a fair amount of this kind of research going on in the United Kingdom. Essentially, the reasons we do this kind of research has much to do with that we want to try to assess what is the usefulness of accounting data in the stock market. In other words, we're really sort of looking for what you might call the demand for information. If we can identify that certain kinds of information are useful, whereas other kinds of information are less useful, then it makes sense, of course, to say that one can provide some ideas to the standard setters in terms of what they ought to be doing and doing, not doing. So that's sort of one of the major reasons why we do spend so much time on these kind of issues. I mean, it's sort of interesting to look at this problem from the point of view of investors, too. But it's also worthwhile to keep in mind that lurking in the background is that we have a sense of good and bad information, accurate and inaccurate measurements. And if we can't make sense out of accounting data as it relates to market values and market value changes, then one might hypothesize that maybe there's something wrong in the accounting measurement. Maybe we should try to change our measures in terms of revenues, expenses, and book values, and whatever have you, in order to see more clearly how market values relates to accounting data. Lurking in the background here is, of course, always a problem that there's much criticism surrounding the nature of historical cost accounting. People always sort of tend to complain about historical cost accounting. It's backward-looking, it's irrelevant, it's of no use, it's nothing the shareholders can conceivably care about. If you want to make money in the stock market, it's the last thing you worry about. You may want to perhaps worry about cash flows. Maybe you should worry about market values or whatever have you. Now, one of the conclusions I'm going to propose tonight here is that once you appreciate how market values do relate to accounting data, then it in fact makes sense to say, at least when it comes to the U.S. data, that the way accounting is actually implemented in the United States is fairly easy in some sense to relate to the market values and market values changes. So in other words, one of the conclusions I'm going to propose here is that the accounting measurements as implemented in the United States make a lot of sense even though they are related to historical cost accounting. So that's sort of basically what I'm going to talk about tonight. And as I move along here, what I'm first going to do is sort of introduce a conceptual framework about how to think about issues before we look at the empirical evidence. We cannot really look at the empirical data unless we have a sense of the conceptual framework and what determines value. So I'm going to review some of the concepts here I discussed Tuesday night. So let me sort of then first give you my basic frame of reference here. You remember what I said, or some of you may remember what I said Tuesday night, is that when you think about the value of a project is equal to the capital expenditure plus the present value of something referred to as residual income. Now we can look at this from a point of view of the stock market too. And essentially the basic conceptual framework here is that when you think about the market value, a natural starting point is to take the book value and then make a correction, so to speak, by taking the present value of future residual income. So what you have to sort of now keep in mind here is that whenever we talk about residual income, essentially it's a measure of corporate profitability. So the general proposition that's lurking in the background here is that the extent to which you expect the company to be profitable, you should expect the market value to exceed the book value. And I'm going to come back to that proposition later on. So from a technical point of view here, I have PT, which simply denotes the market value, BVT, which is the net book value, and then we have our measure of profitability, residual earnings here, and the definition of residual earnings is earnings minus a charge for capital. So the charge for capital here is computed by taking the cost of capital, like 10%, and then you multiply by the book value at the beginning of the period, and then you deduct that from earnings. So again here, keep in mind here is that whenever we expect the residual earnings to be positive, then it makes sense to say that we expect the company to be profitable. On the other hand, if you expect the residual earnings, or the market expects the residual earnings to be negative, then we would think about that as being an unprofitable company. Okay, it should also be clear to you that this notion of value is in fact precisely equivalent to the notion that value equals to the present value of expected dividends. So the only distinction between looking at the present value of expected dividends as opposed to the present value of residual earnings adjusted for book value is that in the former case, in the first case here, we're focusing on the creation of value, whereas if you look at the present value of expected dividends, then the focus becomes on the expected distribution of value created. Now, in the end, the distribution of value has to align with the value created. So these two concepts become precisely equivalent. However, for the purposes of understanding the nature of actual market values as it relates to accounting value, it is much, much better to focus on book value and earnings and residual earnings rather than dividends. Okay, the underlying concept here is simply that we use comprehensive earnings. Now, it's worthwhile to mention here at this point that if you look at the way U.S. accounting is done, comprehensive earnings is a very reasonable approximation. There are some exceptions, foreign currency translation, some changes in accounting principles, accounting for some investments, but overall, these kind of exceptions to comprehensive earnings are of no great significance in the United States. Of course, in the UK, the story is very different because, as far as I understand, in the United Kingdom, assets are frequently written up and written down. These kind of write-up and write-downs frequently bypass the income statement. So in that case, you get a deviation from the notion of comprehensive earnings. I'm going to sort of come back to that later on when I discuss some of the analysis that has been done with respect to UK share values and accounting data. Okay, so you sort of keep in mind here is that the basic framework fundamentally is one that values the present value of expected dividends, and the conceptual framework just converts that into the creation of value as measured by accounting data rather than the distribution of wealth. Okay, a final comment here, which has to do with the actual empirical analysis. Everything is done here on a per share basis. That creates some problems because it is not obvious how comprehensive earnings works on a per share basis, but at least as an approximation, it works out. So there's sort of some somewhat messy problems lurking in the background here, which I'm not going to talk about, but whenever you do things on a per share basis. And again, time permitting, I plan to come back to that at the end of my talk. So that's sort of a basic framework here before we look at the empirical data. Now I'm also going to do a little bit of modeling here, and you have to bear with me. It's going to take me a couple of minutes to run through this. It's fairly straightforward, but it's quite necessary in order to appreciate where the hypothesis come from. So keep in mind here that what I'm trying to do is to explain the nature of equity values in terms of an accounting data. And all we're trying to do here is to organize our thinking in terms of developing appropriate hypotheses. Once we have these hypotheses, then we can analyze the data and we can sort of check up the degree to which empirical analysis, in fact, conforms with these concepts. So what I have here next is a simple model. And essentially what this model is all about is that when you think about the company's profitability, we expect it to evolve rather smoothly. So if a company shows profitability or is expected to show profitability next year, we expect it to evolve smoothly. So the basic model here says that when you think about expected residual 1 year in the future, then you would look at the expected residual earnings in the prior year, and then you would multiply with some constant here. This constant here works sort of like an attenuation parameter, and it's supposed to be here between 0 and 1. So if you think about the underlying mechanism here, it's sort of like if a company shows high profitability in the current year, then depending upon the attenuation parameter, we expect the company to show high profitability in the subsequent year, but somewhat less here. So that's sort of the basic idea with the model. And once you have this model, what you can do next is to go through the kind of analysis which is very similar to the Gordon type of analysis in the case of the present value of expected dividends. In other words, what I can do at this point is just to calculate the present value of future expected residual earnings. So it's just a matter of cranking that out. And the result here is going to be the formula you have right here. It simply says the following thing. When you think about the market value, it equals the book value plus a correction for current profitability. Recall here that RET is residual earnings. If residual earnings is positive, then we have a profitable company. If the residual earnings are negative, then we have an unprofitable company. Therefore, the general idea here is very, very straightforward if you use this model. We expect the market value to exceed the book value depending upon if a company is going to be profitable or unprofitable. Now, we also have to multiply this with the coefficient here, which is omega divided by omega minus 1. And if you think about what's going on here, if you make omega the maximum, which is 1, which means that you expect what you see in terms of current profitability is going to remain in the expectation sense in the future, then you're going to end up with sort of like a capitalization factor. Now, in general, we would expect omega, the parameter, to be slightly less than 1. And that means then that we have a correction when you look at the difference between the market value and the book value, which is sort of a fairly large constant times the current residual earnings. I sort of run it through a very simple example here in order for you to get the feel for what's going on. So let's suppose here that we have a company that has a book value of $50. And let's suppose here that the current earnings equal to $7. And just to make things very simple, let's also assume that the company is currently paying no dividends. So you may ask then, what is a reasonable estimate of the value of this company? So the approach here is that let's start out with the book value. So that's 50. And then we figure out the coefficient here, which is 0.9 divided by 1.1 minus 0.9 here. I assumed here for illustration purposes that the cost of capital is 10% and the attenuation parameter is 0.9, which sort of means that the profitability would decline slowly. But it would decline, but not too slowly. So what we do now here is just to calculate the residual earnings, which is 7 minus 0.10 times 43 here. The 43, of course, is the book value at the beginning of the period. Given the nature of comprehensive earnings, and given the fact that we have no dividends, it's clear that the book value at the beginning of the period must have been equal to 43. So after this very simple calculation here, you figure out that the company is going to trade at a premium. So the market value is going to be $50 plus a premium of $12.15, and that gives us then an estimated market value of $62.15. So that's sort of the basic idea here, and it's a very simple model. The model can, in fact, be made quite a bit more complicated. But the key message I want to convey at this point here is that as a first-order approximation, when you think about the nature of market values, you should think about it as being the book value plus a correction for the current profitability. So that's sort of the first empirical prediction that we can actually come up with here. So this is sort of a basic hypothesis here. By just dividing by the book value in the last expression here, the model suggests that the market-to-book ratio should be explained by return on common equity. That kind of relation has been extensively studied. And what turns out to be the case here is that this hypothesis is very much supported by empirical data. In the United States, if you run this kind of regression analysis or correlation analysis, you will find that the correlation coefficient, or the R-square, I should say, is in the neighborhood of 60%. If you run the same kind of analysis in the UK, you also get very good results, not quite as good as in the United States, and it also depends a little bit upon how you calculate income, because you run into the problem if you want to deal with how you deal with the comprehensive earnings concept. There's also been analysis with respect to Japanese data, German data, and whatever have you. And in general, one can safely assert that this relation, that the difference between the market value and the book value is explained by the current profitability, is very, very strongly supported by empirical data. And it sort of makes, of course, a lot of sense. I mean, if you ever want to invest in a company, I mean, how do you think about what is the value of a company? Well, I mean, you can sort of start out with the book value, being well aware, of course, is that the current book value is not going to be a sufficient piece of information. You've got to make all sorts of correction. And the simplest possible correction is one of looking at the current profitability. Now, we can also refine this analysis in terms of underlying concepts. And basically, the only thing you have to keep in mind here is that from the point of view of the stock market, they care about future profitability, not current profitability. So then we test this hypothesis in a fairly straightforward fashion, because what we can do is simply to look at specific cases. So you can sort of visualize that suppose we have a company that looks very profitable right now, and suppose at the same time the market value is quite low relative to the book value. And then you may ask, what's going on? Well, the answer to that question is fairly easy. What you see now in terms of the current profitability is not what the market expects for the future. This kind of notion is also borne out by the data. So from that point of view, there's sort of very little evidence to contradict the notion that when you think about what determines value, it is book value plus a correction for future profitability. It really doesn't make much difference how you look at the data. This notion always comes out. So we sort of have these two extreme cases here, that one case is current high profitability and low market-to-book ratio. In most of these instances, if you actually look what happens to the company, you're going to find out that the profitability will increase. And then you sort of have other extreme here, and this other extreme is the case when you have low profitability currently and high market-to-book value, which suggests, of course, that you're going to see high profitability in the future. So if you study these kind of cases, the empirical data, in general, will show that in those cases, you're going to have a change. In fact, you're going to have the company is going to experience a change in the profitability. So there's sort of certain important concepts that's lurking in the background here in terms of what you think about determines value. And the two concepts are fairly straightforward ones we appreciate. First of all, keep in mind here is that what the market cares about is future profitability. And the second thing you keep in mind is that in general, what you see in terms of current profitability is going to be a reasonable indicator of what you're going to see in terms of future profitability. Once you have that second notion, then you end up with a fairly straightforward proposition that the current profitability is going to have a high correlation with the current market-to-book value, and this is precisely what happens in empirical data. There are, of course, exceptions because you see these transition cases, but in general, I think that that's sort of one of the more useful notions in any investment analysis, that the fact that you can actually look at the current profitability in general is a reasonable indication of the profitability in the future, and therefore, when you think about the difference between the market value and the book value, you can sort of make corrections due to the current profitability. So this is sort of one of the important points that comes out of this analysis. Okay, now, it turns out that there's another way you can think about what's going on, and it is really quite straightforward here. Let me just sort of run through the some very straightforward algebra here with you. Essentially, if you look at the relation, the theoretical relation we had here, it's that the market value is equal to the book value plus the constant times the current profit, plus the current residual earnings. The way we can rewrite that is given in this expression here. And if you forget about the dividends, which are not terribly important anyhow from the empirical point of view, then you notice here is that there's some weight attached to current earnings capitalized. So we really have rho minus 1, but you can forget about the rho and just take rho minus 1. And then we have some weight attached to the current book value. So as an approximation, what happens is that when you think about market value, we can think about it from the point of view of the balance sheet and the income statement at the same time. And essentially, the empirical proposition here is that when the market tries to figure out the market value, they sort of have two bottom line indicators. On the one hand, they have a balance sheet, and the balance sheet indicates the book value. On the other hand, the stock market also has access to a current income statement. The current income statement has a bottom line number, the current earnings. How much do you want to pay attention to these numbers? Well, it depends a little bit upon the circumstances, but it should be clear here is that that what really comes out of this analysis is that as far as the market is concerned, one can hypothesize that both current earnings and the current book value sort of contributes to the information that the market uses when we try to assess what the intrinsic value of the company is. Now, the way the analysis goes here is that you can actually figure out the degree to which earnings are important as opposed to the current market value. The higher this omega parameter is, which sort of acts as a persistence parameter in terms of the current profitability, the more important are earnings relative to the book value. So the idea is as follows. Suppose you have a company that shows high profitability, and suppose that you expect that this high profitability is going to persist to a very high degree. Notice here that I'm saying the word expect. We don't know what's going to happen in the future. For those kind of companies, there is a lot of emphasis on earnings. On the other hand, if you sort of visualize that currently you see a company that has very high profitability, but suppose that you don't expect that this high profitability is going to last very long, well, then earnings are much less important, and there's going to be much more attention paid to the current book value. So this is a very simple concept, which is very useful because it sort of emphasizes the fact that the true primary financial statements in accounting is the income statement and the balance sheet. Both of these statements have sort of bottom line value indicators, earnings and book value. And we should keep in mind that in general, what we would expect is that the market pays attention to both of these numbers. Now, this hypothesis can actually be tested. The actual testing of this kind of hypothesis gets a little bit complicated because there are non-linearities. So what one can do here is sort of look at companies with the same earnings per share, and then one can check out what they have in book values, and then you can sort of run through a correlation between market values and book values. And So that was actually 2Y. One can also keep the book value fixed, and so you can sort of visualize that we collect data for all sorts of companies with roughly the same book value per share, and then we can look at their earnings, and then we can check up if the market values correlate with those earnings. If you look at these kind of hypotheses, the evidence is very supportive. So it's sort of the one conclusion that comes out of this, which often surprises people, is that when you think about what determines the market value, you really shouldn't forget about the book value. Sort of everybody feels that it's okay to say that market value somehow should relate to earnings. But it's much less common that people sort of tend to be aware of that, in fact, the book value also comes into play. So what I always emphasize when I talk about these kind of issues here is that if you have a bunch of companies, they all have the same earnings, and you ask which company is worth the most, well, what you can do then, and it will work as an approximation, as a reasonable approximation when you look at data, is look at their book values, and then you're going to be able to get some understanding of the market values. Okay, so that's sort of another point that I'd like to make here, is that when you think about how market values relate to the financial statements, it is certainly consistent with empirical evidence that both earnings and book value contribute to the information that determines market values. Incidentally, I sort of always like to point out when you look at this notion here of market value as being a weighted average of capitalized earnings and book value, that's something they adopted in the German tax law. The problem they face in Germany, as well as many other countries, is how do you tax privately held companies? So, I mean, those companies are not going to be paid dividends. You don't know what their market values are because they're privately held. So what the tax authorities need to do is to come up with some formula that sort of gives them a reasonable, quote-unquote, estimate of what the market value would have been if the company has, in fact, been traded. So the solution, according to the German tax law, is that they put the capitalization factor equal to 10, and the weight put on earnings is given by 2/3, the weight that's put on book value is equal to by 1/3, and it's sort of interesting to read the documentation associated with this tax law. Someone actually once translated for me, because the reasoning was amazingly, in my book, elegant, because they actually understood that this kind of reasoning is precisely equivalent to looking at the market value as being equal to the book value plus a correction for a profitability. Okay, the next thing I'd like to talk about is some basic ideas about how we explain market returns. And now we're shifting the perspective somewhat, because rather than looking at market values, we're now going to look at the change in market values. Now, it turns out that this subject matter has a very long, and one likes to say distinguished, but that's a little bit harder, but it has certainly a very long history in accounting research in the United States. The 1966 here is actually incorrect. It should be 1968, as it were. So it's sort of 25 years of experience. The story, the way it goes here, is that once the databases came around in the United States, which sort of happened in the mid-60s, then it was sort of inevitable that people sort of were going to try their hand at explaining what determines the changes in market values. And at the time, it has to be said that it was far from obvious whether that kind of research effort was going to succeed. I mean, again, you always got to keep in mind here, lurking in the background are always contentions that market values and changes in market values have nothing to do with what you see in the financial statements. So at the time, it was sort of a rather open-ended hypothesis in terms of, was it indeed going to be the case that you can look at accounting data and the disclosure of earnings numbers, and then explain what's going to happen to the changes in the company's market values. The first study here is referred to as being the Boyle-Brown study here, and what they did was a fairly straightforward affair. They looked at changes in earnings. So they sort of looked at two possibilities. On the one hand, earnings may be up. On the other hand, earnings may be down. So they referred to that as being good news and bad news. And then you can do the same thing with the market return. So the market value may be up or the market value may be down. And then you can check up and test the hypothesis. Is it the case that if the earnings are up but the market value is up, and the same consistency when earnings are down? And the overall conclusion here was that, yes, indeed, there is a correlation. However, it was also fairly apparent that if you look at annual data here, that the correlation was very, very modest. It was small. And in terms of subsequent analysis, one can sort of roughly work with the correlation coefficient of less than 10%. It depends upon how you do the statistics, and it depends upon the data, it depends upon the year, and depends upon the companies and so forth. But roughly speaking here, the underlying correlation is very small, certainly less than 10%. So that was sort of the state of affairs in the late 1960s, and that led to an unbelievably large body of empirical research in accounting. I mean, there have been hundreds of studies published with respect to this problem, and there have probably been thousands of unpublished studies, which sort of gives you an indication of the degree to which one can publish papers in the accounting journals here. And what people tried to do, of course, was to come up with all sorts of new statistical techniques. That's always a temptation. You can try to redo the statistics, fancy econometrics, all sorts of analysis that tries to nail down what goes on if you change the statistics. And another thing you can do, and this shouldn't be surprising to you, one could, of course, argue here that we should try different variables. Why focus on earnings when we know that so many people emphasize cash flows? So a much more interesting venue of research here, avenue of research focused on the degree to which cash flows, dividends, alternative measures of earnings, in fact, would do a better job in explaining returns. Now, it turned out what really happens here is that results were very, very disappointing from the point of view that changes in statistical technique, changes in the definition of variables, all sorts of attempts to deal with measurement errors, had very little impact upon what you actually saw. In general, people found it, and this was sort of after 20 years of experience, or I think it was exactly 22 years of experience when Baruch Lev wrote a review article, that the results were very disappointing. In spite of these hundreds of published papers, when you actually look at the totality of what they came up with, it was very, very little, if anything, that was in fact an improvement upon what the Boyle and Brown study had accomplished in 1968. So that was sort of a problem people faced. Why is it that earnings do such a lousy job in explaining changes in market value? So some people sort of then picked up on this and said that, this sort of just corroborates what we've known all along. There's no information really in earnings. There's very little information in earnings. There are no reasons why we should believe that the stock market pays attention to earnings. So these were some of the conclusions that people came up with about 4 or 5 years ago. And then what happens was that everything changed because there were two researchers named Easton and Harris. And what they did was to look at the problem from a very, very much simpler perspective, which is the capital budgeting perspective. So that's what they actually introduced. And so essentially what they said was the following thing here, is that if we want to think about how to explain changes in market value, what we really want to do is just to keep in mind that people invest in stocks because they expect their companies to create value. The accountant then measures the creation in value. So if the realization of earnings, the measurement of the creation of value, is high relative to what was paid for it, then we should see an upward adjustment in the stock price. So you notice here the enormous, the incredibly simple perspective. The line here is just supposed to be the timeline. So at the beginning of some year, we can visualize our market value PT. Then 1 year later, we're going to observe a market value, which is here PT plus one. And during that period, the company is going to recognize some earnings. So what we may want to do now is just something which is very simple. We take the dependent variable, the difference in market values divided by initial market value, and then we look at how this investment pans out from the point of view of investors, assuming what the investors are doing here is to buy themselves some expected earnings. So you sort of see what happens here is that the hypothesis is that if earnings are high relative to the initial price, in some sense that's sort of like a good capital expenditures, then what you would expect to happen is that the earnings, that the return variable should be high. I've sort of disregarded dividends here just to keep matters simple. It turns out from an empirical point of view, that's not very important. So if you take those kind of cases, if you forget about those kind of complications, this is sort of a general idea. So you notice here that the variable that's going to explain the changes in the market value is just a reflection of the earnings recognized for the period. So there are basically three concepts that you can think about that support this hypothesis. So there are sort of different scenarios you can lay out why this should be reasonable. The first scenario is that this should work if, in some sense, the market value in general was very closely approximated by the book value. Now, that doesn't turn out to be the case, but it's sort of worthwhile to keep in mind here is that even if the book value is a very important indicator of the market value, this kind of hypothesis should work. But it's also the case that if the market value is reasonably approximated by capitalized earnings, then this kind of analysis is also appropriate. So that sort of really comes back to the concepts I had earlier. In general, we can think about the market value as being sort of some weighted average of capitalized earnings and the current book value. And as long as that's true, then it turns out that this framework is quite appropriate. Now, there's a third concept here, which is going to be important later on here, is that if it were the case that price equal to capitalized expected earnings next year, then one should also expect that this kind of analysis should work. But the key thing I underscored here is that it's expected earnings next year. And if that's not the good model, then we're going to run into trouble. So the empirical analysis here now is based on regressing, just correlating changes in market values, in other words, the market returns, on earnings for the period divided by the market value at the beginning of the period. So that's sort of the nature of the statistical analysis. And in terms of result here, there was an improvement, and the improvements here, sorry, you can, if you want to think about the order of magnitudes, the usual R squared was sort of in the 9% kind of vicinity, and now it sort of gets up to 10 to 12%. So there's sort of an improvement. But it's not exactly dramatic. It's some people would even argue that it's disappointing. However, it's sort of worthwhile to mention here that when these results came around, which was only a few years ago, it sort of created somewhat a sensation because their line of reasoning was much simpler. and the results were better, and at least on the surface, their line of reasoning seemed to run at cross purposes with the way people thought about the problem previously. So there was much debate about this particular paper in terms of the underlying concepts and so forth. I think as of today, when I'm speaking here now, there's no doubt that this paper sort of was very significant in terms of improving upon the analysis. Now we get down to the next issue, which is sort of actually very crucial because it sort of takes us back to my what I said Tuesday. The one thing you have to keep in mind now, of course, is sort of a rather obvious aspect, that when the market invests, they have a horizon that goes beyond 1 year. So, I mean, it may be that it's a reasonable approximation that expected earnings determines the current price, where expected earnings is just for the next year. But that's just an approximation. And you remember when I sort of discussed the nature of the capital budget decision, it may not be a good approximation. What you really should do is to keep firmly in mind that's earnings for several years that are important when you invest in a company. So that means that in some sense what you can think about is that earnings for shorter periods in some sense have measurements error in them. And earnings for shorter periods do not quite measure the creation of wealth. In order to eliminate measurement errors, we sort of have to stretch the periods at which we're looking for earnings. And that's of course something that we teach in accounting theory. And elementary, even in elementary intermediate accounting, the one thing we do tend to emphasize for students is that if you look at earnings for very short periods, they tend to be very sensitive to accounting principles, and therefore you have to be very cautious how you use earnings that measure earnings for very short periods. On the other hand, as you extend the period for which you're looking at earnings, the number becomes more and more robust and less sensitive to accounting principles. So in some sense, as we extend the period over which we're looking at earnings, then we're going to come up with a much more accurate measurement of earnings. So that leads to the next study here, which is very, very straightforward. And they do exactly the same thing as Easton-Harris, except for one important difference. Now we're going to look at earnings for a long period, and in particular we may go as long period as 10 years. So what we do now here is to ask the following question. Suppose you look at the market return over a 10-year period. So the dependent variable here, now to make it more explicit, because this is the data that's actually used, so we can sort of visualize the market value of a company in 1990, compare that to the market value in 1980, and then we can compare that to the company's performance as measured by 10 years of earnings. Now again here, I don't worry about dividends. If you make appropriate corrections for dividends, everything is going to work out fine, but it's just to keep a simplified exposition. I sort of hope that you all appreciate the simplicities of ideas. On the one hand, you have the company's performance as measured by the market return. We're looking at the 10-year period. And on the other hand, we have a company's market performance as measured by the sum of 10 years of earnings. So that's the independent variable. Now, if you run this kind of analysis, then you're going to find a dramatic improvement in the R-square. And I'm soon going to show you a table here. But essentially, what I want you to keep in mind is a very, very simple idea. If you want to explain returns, and if you want to do it from a point of view of looking at the problem as a capital expenditure decision, in other words, you're looking at the whole thing from a point of view that what the market is really doing is to buy earnings. And then if you look at a 10-year period as opposed to a shorter period, then to a very significant degree, you're going to find that the earnings will in fact explain the change in the market value. So the 66% here is actually sort of in some ways an understatement of what's really going on. But that's sort of what happens here. And if you shorten the window, and if you look at 5-year earnings and 5 years market return, then you're going to find a corresponding decline in the explanatory power. And the way you can just think about it is that if you expand the window, the earnings become more and more accurately measured. So it's sort of a way of eliminating measurement errors. In 1 year, you're down to 11%. Let me show you the next table here, because I think it sort of captures the ideas quite nicely. So the data here reflects, I think it's something like 1,200 U.S. corporations. So these are sort of all the ones that are traded on the New York Stock Exchange and also to some degree on the over-the-counter and American Stock Exchange. So we have 1,200 companies. And then we looked at their performance over a 10-year period. So the Y variable here is the market return over the 10-year period. So forgetting about dividends, the way you think about it is the change in market value per share divided by the market value per share at the beginning of that 10-year period. Now, it turns out that this was a rather good decade for stocks, but that doesn't make too much difference in terms of our analysis. Then there's also an X variable here, and this X variable reflects 10 years of earnings divided by what was paid for those earnings or for expected earnings at the beginning of a 10-year period. So this is the decade of the 1980s. And you notice now what happens here is that for each and every company, it's ranked in terms of how it's performed on the Y variable versus the X variable. So a company may have ranked very highly on the market return, and it may or may not rank very highly in terms of its earnings performance. So you can do that for each and every company, rank them in terms of the two variables. Then you can sort everything into four quartiles. And so that gives you in terms of the X variable here, we have a top quartile, and then we have a Y variable. Starting with the left, we have a top quartile, and then we have a second quartile, third quartile, fourth quartile. And then we can just sort of count the number of instances for various outcomes. So that's the scheme here. It's very straightforward. What happens now is the following thing. I hope the picture is very apparent. It says that, of course, that most companies end up on the diagonal. Okay. So what it simply means here is that if you look at any company's earnings over a 10-year period, and suppose those earnings were high relative to what was paid for those earnings at the beginning of the period, then the company almost surely is going to show a very high market return. So this sort of relates to the capital budgeting problem. If you can buy your earnings cheaply, then you can expect that the market return is going to work out. That works in the long run. It works less in the short run. But in the long run, you can be quite sure that that's going to work. So most of observations here fall on the diagonal. And that is sort of the important point. Now, we do have some exceptions here at the corner. So you notice here that there's indeed a lousy company here, and you sort of have to use your imagination to visualize what happens, is that the company had fabulous earnings, or quite nice earnings relative to what was paid for them. But the market turned out to be very lousy. And the reason that happens, of course, is that you have seen during this period a very significant change in the profitability. It's also worthwhile that you look at these numbers here to so you get a sense of investment realities. If you look at the numbers in the far right column here, you notice what I've calculated is the median of the independent variable. So the independent variable here is the aggregate earnings divided by the price at the beginning of the period. So essentially, if you get 4.02, that means that if you paid $100 for the stock, then 10 years later, the company has actually racked up $400 in earnings. So does that sound good? Yeah, it sounds very good given that accounting does its job. And indeed, the market comes to appreciate that if you can buy your earnings that cheaply, the stock value is going to be marked up. Again, there are exceptions, but you notice here that this is precisely what happens. Well, on the other hand, if you look at the other end here, if you look at the lowest quartile of performance in terms of earnings, you find out here that if you paid $100 for the stock, then you wait 10 years, and the company has only racked up $39 in earnings. So that doesn't seem quite right. You can certainly do better investing in bonds. So, of course, in general, if the earnings are that low relative to what you paid for them, there will be a penalty. And this penalty shows up here that, in general, the market return is very, very low. Now, again, of course, there are some exceptions, but these are very rare. And so it may be cases when the earnings are not very high and relative to what you paid for them. But maybe if you're lucky, then you're still going to the investment may still work out. But it's a very rare case. So the one conclusion here, which I like to emphasize, is that there's absolutely no evidence to contradict the notion that if you invest in a company and you wait 5, 7, 8 years, and if the company piles up good earnings relative to what you paid for them, then your investment is actually very likely to work out. So from that point of view, it also goes without saying here is that it does make a lot of sense that the company itself should pay attention to the generation of earnings. Because think about it from the point of view of the company. The company is supposed to incur capital expenditures. If the company can generate high earnings relative to underlying capital expenditures, then ultimately these earnings are going to surface in the financials. The market is going to come to recognize that these earnings are high relative to what's paid for the earnings, and therefore what you're going to see is a change in the market value. So this is sort of how the world works, and I think it's a very sobering experience because it sort of emphasizes that what many investors emphasize since the days of Graham and Dodd, but also in contemporary times, that it's really very easy to invest. All you have to do is to keep in mind that what you want to do is to buy your earnings cheaply. In the short run, you may be in for some disappointments, but if you stick to your guns and the earnings ultimately surface, then the investment is going to work out quite nicely. Now, it's very easy to see what happens here if you go through some algebra. And essentially, what you want to do is just to keep in mind here that when you think about the market return, there are two parts to it. And the algebra is very, very straightforward. It simply says that the market return is equal to earnings divided by the price at the beginning of the period, plus, and this is sort of a tricky matter, is plus an adjustment that you have to make, and this adjustment reflects the change in the premium at the end of the period versus the premium at the end of the period. So you notice here, what I have here is the price at the end of horizon minus the book value at the end of horizon. So that's equal to the premium at the end of horizon. And when you look at the premium at the beginning of horizon, and then you take that difference, and so if you combine that with the earnings, then you're going to end up with the market return. So when you think about investment, in some ways it's quite simple, at least in principle, is that the primary objective is that you want to buy your earnings cheaply. So that's what you want to do. And you want a long horizon, because that's precisely what the empirical evidence emphasizes. It may be quite easy to buy your earnings cheaply if you're just looking for earnings for next year. However, if you're too myopic, what might well happen is that there's a penalty when it comes to the second term. In other words, if you buy a stock and they look cheap relative to expected earnings for next year, frequently those are precisely the companies that are going to have a reduction in their premiums. So the secondary objective here refers to that what you want to do is to try to determine if a company is going to have a change in the premium. And if you recall what I said earlier tonight, the change in the premium here is going to reflect the change in the profitability. The premium at this point in time, in other words, at the end of the horizon, is going to reflect the profitability at that point in time. The premium currently reflects the anticipated profitability for the next few years. So essentially what you're trying to do here are two things. First of all, buy your earnings cheaply. And the second thing, what you want to do is to make sure that these earnings, in some sense, are of high quality. And what that means is that you want to pick companies that are likely to have an expansion in their premium. And the way you identify those companies is by sort of identifying companies that are likely to have to show a continuous ongoing improvement in their profitability. If you can do these two things, then, of course, you should be able to get rich. So it's not necessarily to do it. But in terms of investment analysis from a traditional fundamental point of view, this is what it comes down to. And you notice here that from the point of view of analyzing the data, essentially what we're saying here is that in the grand scheme of things, if you make an investment for the long term, this variable here, the first one, is much more important than the second term. On the other hand, if you invest for the short term, then you're going to find that the second term is much more important than the first term. Okay, now it also turns out that the one thing that happens is that these terms correlate positively if and only if you have long periods. So what happens is sort of kind of interesting. If you can buy your earnings cheaply and you hold the stock for a long time, then, and this is very nice, you can expect to get a bonus from a point of view that, on the average, you're also going to see an expansion in the company's premium. And if you look at the data very closely that I had on the previous slide and also some of these regression coefficients, then you can arrive at that conclusion. So that's sort of very worthwhile to keep in mind in terms of how the stock market works. Earnings are posted. And if over the long haul earnings are much better than the initial price, then market values adjustments are made. But at the same time, there are always these calibrations going on in terms of expected changes in profitability. Okay, so that's sort of another important conclusion here. Now, I notice that time is running here, so the next few slides here I'm going to run a little bit faster. The next question we may, of course, ask here refers to the notion that earnings are so important. In my previous slide, of course, you know, my argument was that what's important here are earnings, but you can argue that it's not really earnings, it's something else that happens to correlate with earnings. So once we've done this kind of analysis, the next thing we can do is to see if there are some other variables that work better than earnings. In other words, my claim is that what you want to focus is to buy your earnings on cheaply. Someone else might claim if you focus on something else, then you're going to do much better. So that's sort of the next task in terms of empirical analysis. My contention here is going to be quite strong. Nothing beats earnings in terms of what you want to buy cheaply. And let me run through the analysis here quite quickly. Think about the following problem, which is sort of a very simple way of looking at earnings versus cash flows. Suppose we split up earnings into two components, earnings before depreciation expense, and then we have a depreciation expense. And then maybe the argument here is that depreciation, we all know people sometimes claim that it's just a bookkeeping entry. Depreciation expense does not deal with economic reality. So maybe what we really should be looking at is the earnings number before the depreciation expense. And maybe that's what we should try to buy cheaply. So that's sort of the reasonable hypothesis. On the other hand, one can of course hypothesize that the depreciation expense is no different from the cash expense. And that sort of leads down to the whole issue of earnings versus cash flow here. So what we can do now here is to run the following regression model. Dependent variable return, and now we're going to have two independent regression variables. One is the first variable, which is earnings before depreciation expense, and then we're going to have a second variable, which is the depreciation expense. Now, what do we want to hypothesize here? Well, my hypothesis is that we're going to have two hypotheses. One is, of course, that earnings is a good number. We want earnings to be high. Therefore, the higher earnings before taxes are, the higher is the return. And that sort of goes without saying. More subtle is the second issue here, is that the depreciation expense is bad. In other words, if a company incurs high depreciation expense, there will be a penalty in the market value. So that's sort of the second hypothesis, and which is related to the first one. So then we can take everything one step further, and that's to hypothesize that there's no distinction between depreciation expense as opposed to other types of expense, revenues and expenses. So that's sort of a general idea here now, is that we have to ask a question: is depreciation expense any different from other expenses? For those of you who are a little bit older, you probably know about this problem because it was addressed in a very well-known article by Professor Payton in the early 60s. And he liked to talk about the so-called cash flow illusion. The point he made, and I think people should read this article, the point he made very forcefully is that depreciation expense is no different from a cash expense. The only difference is that it's more difficult to measure. However, over longer periods, we know how to measure depreciation expense very accurate. For short periods, we're going to have measurement errors. For longer periods, we're going to measure our depreciation expense very accurate. And I think that's an extremely nice way of looking at it. We are really talking about a cash flow illusion. We have cash expenses, we have cash revenues, we have accrued expenses, we had accrued revenues, but on the whole, if you look at empirical data, there's not much of a distinction. So you notice what happens here now, and this is really quite straightforward. If you look for a 10-year window, and keep in mind here is that the idea is very simple, that if you look earnings for a 10-year window, you're going to have depreciation expense for 10 years. The argument is that's a fairly accurate measurement of economic depreciation expense. So what happens here? Well, look at the numbers. The numbers are virtually identical if you look at the whole thing from a 10-year perspective. So you have 1.68 here and minus 1.61. So that means that expenses are indeed bad. The depreciation expenses are bad because the sign is negative. So the higher the depreciation expense is for a fixed earnings before depreciation expense, the less is going to be the market return. But in fact, because these coefficients are virtually identical, from a market's point of view, and make no mistake, this is a very strong statement, from a market's point of view, they don't care if you're talking about depreciation expense or cost of goods sold or wage expense or whatever have you. An expense is an expense. And therefore, I'm quite happy if I can buy my earnings cheaply, no matter what the compositions of earnings are. If you go to shorter periods, however, as predicted by Professor Payton more than 20 years ago, yes, you are going to have measurement problems associated with depreciation expense. So over shorter periods, when you try to explain earnings, you're going to find that the coefficient is much less than the second coefficient is much less than the first coefficient here. So the conclusion here is, for long windows, the distinction between accruals and cash flow is of no importance. There are other ways you can cut the analysis, and I have some more slides here, but again, the message is going to be exactly the same. If you look at earnings for long periods, the actual composition of the line items makes virtually no difference. The revenues are good, expenses are bad, and you don't really care about the nature of the revenues, expenses. They may be financial, they may be operating, they may be cash expenses, they may be accrued expenses or whatever have you. In the end, all revenues are equivalent, they're good, all expenses are equivalent, they're bad, and what you do is to sum the revenue, sum and deduct all the expenses, and that's going to be a very accurate measurement of earnings. So if you look here at the last few slides here, you can actually get the numbers. Let me next sort of summarize here what I see as being critical in terms of the empirical findings. And this slide is not in your package here, so for reasons too painful to describe. So let me just sort of next just summarize here. And I sort of like to think that, you know, these are very easy ideas, and you should certainly take them to heart, because if you ever have to invest, my feeling is that if you forget about these very simple prescriptions, you're likely to end up in trouble. First of all, the thing to keep in mind here is that if you want to explain the market-to-book ratio, by far the best variable is the return on common equity. And this variable works exceedingly well in most countries, but you need comprehensive earnings. And I sort of like to add here is that this works particularly well precisely because you do not engage in what you may call mark-to-market accounting. If you change the accounting principles and start to deviate from historical cost accounting principles, then this kind of relationship doesn't work that well. So it actually sort of turns out here, and I wish I had time to talk about it, but the reasons return on common equity is such a useful number is precisely when it's cast in the context of historical cost accounting. Okay, and when you think about this proposition here, what's lurking in the background is that the current return on common equity is, in general, a very good indicator of the kind of profitability you're going to see in the future. And this is a necessary and sufficient condition for this to be the case. So if you change the accounting principles in some sense, and you do your accounting in a very sloppy fashion, then what you're going to find out is that current profitability is not a good indicator of future profitability. Once that's true, then you're going to find out that the first proposition is not true either. Okay, I also want you to keep in mind here is that when you think about what determines current market value, don't ever fall into the trap and just presume that current earnings are important whereas current book value is unimportant. There is nothing in the empirical evidence, once you look at it correctly, to suggest that that's in the case. And it's very easy to think about that problem if you think about a company that has zero profits. If a company has zero profits and you try to figure out what is the company worth, of course you have to take a look at the book value. And why is that true? Well, because the current book value is going to be an indicator of future earnings. So that's sort of the third thing you want to keep in mind here. And the fourth thing you want to keep in mind here is that that it makes a lot of sense to say that the current market value reflects future expected earnings once you look at earnings over a sufficiently long horizon. 5 years turns out to be reasonably a good indicator. So essentially what it comes down to here is that over a short run you're going to have measurement errors in earnings, but earnings over a long period like 5 or 10 years pretty much indicate with some accuracy the value that has been created by the company. So if you can buy 5-year earnings cheaply, it's very likely then that your investment is going to pan out. And the final point is just that earnings are earnings. There's absolutely no evidence to suggest that somehow looking at cash flows, future cash flows, rather than earnings, or to pay attention to specific line items and forget about other line items is going to do you much good. In the end, all revenues tend to be the same, they add. All expenses tend to be the same, they add. And you can take the expenses and deduct with the revenues, that's going to be the bottom line earnings. The same phenomena is true for you find with respect to the balance sheet. You can do other kinds of analysis and you're going to arrive at the same conclusion. So that is sort of pretty much the end of the story. And the last thing I like to do is just sort of to make a few comments concerning what sort of accounting policy implications are for this. there's sort of a few things that's sort of lurking in the background, which is not totally apparent. The first thing I'd like to emphasize here is that this kind of analysis requires that you think about earnings as being comprehensive earnings. Once you look at the earnings that deviate from comprehensive earnings, they're going to lead to all sorts of trouble. The second thing, which is sort of worthwhile to keep in mind from a policy point of view, is that the reason this analysis works so well is precisely because we use historical cost accounting. And the way historical cost accounting really works is that it emphasizes profitability analysis. The emphasis is not on the balance sheet. The emphasis is not on the income statement. The emphasis is on both numbers in conjunction with each other. Once you think about these two numbers in conjunction with each other, then you get the notion of profitability, and your line of reasoning is going to be fairly straightforward. And another thing that comes out of this stuff is that this kind of reasoning and analysis works quite well as the accounting is not too conservative. So sort of lurking in the background here, which I haven't discussed in any extensive detail, is the notion that on the average, return on common equity should equal to the discount factor. If the average return on common equity starts to deviate strongly from the discount factor, then you're going to have all sorts of problems. And my final point is a simple observation concerning cash flow analysis. Over the last 5-10 years, there's been much discussion in U.S. Standard setting concerning the importance of a cash flow analysis and a cash statement. And we have similar discussions in the U.K. as far as I understand. My claim is fairly straightforward. It's far from obvious what useful information one can extract from a cash flow statement. The income statement and the balance sheet, in my mind, are the primary financial statements, especially if they're reconciled properly with the statement of changes in owner's equity. And these are the statements you really want to pay attention to. And as far as I'm concerned, all the available evidence suggests that if you want to explain market values and changes in market values, looking at cash flow numbers is not going to do you much good. Okay, thank you very much for your attention.